This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Sound recording and editing was by Tom Hayes of Anglia Ruskin University, Cambridge. Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 22nd of October 2008, our guest speaker was Professor Gerhard Michael Ambrosi of the University of Trier in Germany, speaking on the theme Keynes, Pigou and the General Theory. The full paper can be downloaded from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website, together with a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk. Enjoy listening.
Thank you very much, Mark. It is a great opportunity to be here in Cambridge, in Keynes's place. And not only that Keynes lived here, I also lived here. But that was 39 years ago, about. And I was on the trails of Keynes, and I'm still on the trails of Keynes, and I don't know whether I have arrived. But it is a marvelous opportunity to put my ideas in front of an audience of connoisseurs. And it is, of course, a very special pleasure for me that Vicky Chick is here and Jens Hölscher, whom I've also known for a long time and in intensive discussions in Berlin in particular, and also in London. Now, the vast literature about Keynes and the general theory demonstrates that there are many ways to approach this important book. You know, in the seminar, you will talk about Keynes and Marshall, Keynes and Marx, and I remind you of John Robertson, who liked to see Keynes and Ricardo in some way combined, and especially the way she wanted to see Keynes and Sraffa combined is very interesting. And I quote here Sraffa's book on production of commodities by means of commodities was not published until 1960. Sraffa had shown a draft to Keynes in 1928. Keynes evidently did not make much of it, and Sraffa, in turn, never made much of the general theory. It is the task of the post-Keynesians to reconcile the two. Now, I will not approach the Keynes and Pigou topic in this way, that it is us who have to reconcile them. I want to show that there is a continuum of the development of ideas between Keynes and Pigou, and actually you will see from my disposition that I call the general theory in a post I call the general theory in certain aspects as a post-Pigouvian event. I would like to suggest to see the general theory in a post-Pigouvian perspective, and then I proceed to see the general theory in an anti-Pigouvian perspective. In an appendix, I put a number of more technical matters. And the appendix, the outline as it is here, is a little bit scrambled. The sub points should come under A and not under B. But maybe it doesn't derange you. Okay, let me talk a little bit about Keynes and Pigou. There is the folklore that Keynes and Pigou were bitter enemies. They were not really, and even towards the end of their respective lives, I think they found a modus vivendi. But they were very friendly with each other at the beginning of their meeting, and their meeting was for a very long time here in Cambridge. Pigou was 5 years the senior of Keynes, And he also was academically the senior of Keynes, since he was the professor, and Keynes was just a don, a fellow of King's College. I have in the paper a very appreciative comment by Pigou of the young Keynes. Keynes was 21 years old at the time, and Pigou in the Granta wrote, "Mr. Keynes contrives to be clear-headed without making muddle-headed people hate him. That is a remarkable thing, which demonstrates that, besides the minor gift of cleverness, he has the major one of sympathy." Well, probably Pigou did think a little bit differently later on. But for most of the time, Keynes and Pigou were colleagues, they were colleagues also from a very early age. I quote the first book of Pigou's, The Principles and Methods of Industrial Peace, and there in 1906 he quotes in the foreword Keynes, that Keynes worked at his Appendix A, or that he helped him in this Appendix A. Now, when you look at this Appendix A, it is rather interesting. It has an application of the Marshallian offer curve analysis to labor market analysis. And Marshall himself, he at one stage, when he went through his offer curve analysis, he said this could be a nice instrument for analyzing industrial disputes, and so they made a first attempt. I think it is interesting to recollect that, because from there you can appreciate that Keynes was aware of the complexities of labor market analysis. You have, and Pigou starts from supply and demand analysis, which of course is the normal thing, but then he goes to this offer curve analysis of labor market, and then of course you have this disutility analysis, which also was very well known to Keynes, and one can make a special point that Keynes indeed did accept this Jevonsian approach to the disutility of labor, and then you have also the production possibility curves, which shows then the equilibrium in the economy. When does controversy come up? The reason why Keynes and Pigou entered economic folklore, not as colleagues but as foes, is of course closely connected with the writing of and debating of the general theory. There is a rupture indeed between the two in this connection, and there has been much speculation why this rupture occurred. Most of those who comment on this controversy put the responsibility almost exclusively on Keynes. His motives are often stated as having been rather low ethical standard. And I won't go into these rather slanderous comments. The answer why the Great Depression of 1929-30 and the responses of the economic establishment given explanation is the following. Since 1929, Keynes was member of the Treasury's Macmillan Committee investigating finance and industry. He also was member of the Governmental Committee of Economic Advisers. Within this latter framework, he obtained authority from Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald in 1930 to set up a committee of economists. Keynes was authorized to decide its composition and to formulate its brief, and then maybe we move to this table. The Committee of Economists was composed of Keynes as chairman, then he had H.D. Henderson as a member, which he proposed, then there was A.C. Pigou, and then was Lionel Robbins, who just had become professor at the LSE the year before, and there was Josiah Stamp, who was a very distinguished banker and governor of the Bank of England. Now, these were great experts, and Keynes wrote about his selection. They are well accustomed to the most up-to-date academic methods and ways of discussing these problems. They are essentially reasonable and good members of a committee and happen to have given already a good deal of time and thought to the problem which would be set them. Now, the problem which would be set to them is also on the table: to review the present economic condition of Great Britain, to examine the causes which are responsible for it, and to indicate the conditions of recovery. The background is the Great Depression, which was unfolding then. And within the year of 1930, they tried to come to answers. Now, Keynes was very confident that they come to a consensus, and he was totally wrong. The committee was a disaster as far as his activity as a chairman was concerned. Lionel Robbins, whom he thought to get into the crowd, he refused to sign the final report. He had a minority report of his own. Then there was some debate: is one person a minority? Well, then they said, okay, he may have his minority report. Pigou, whom Keynes thought that he would play along, he had a one-page diverging opinion. Henderson was not really very much in favor. Henderson was interesting because 1 year before, Henderson and Keynes wrote an article which generally is taken as the precursor of the multiplier model. And so they all said that the wage adjustment, of course, public works could be done, but only when they are sensible, and they must be sensibly chosen, and so on. So Keynes did not in the least get across his idea, his budding idea of effective demand. How did he get his idea of effective demand into that context? Well, he said, we need a so-called revenue tariff, that is a flat tariff which discourages imports in general, not specific imports, in order to let effective demand stay within Britain and not go abroad. Now, for this, he only found ridicule, and when he said, okay, I must go to the press, and he published this in 31, he got a barrage of opposition organized by Sir, Beveridge at that time, the director of the London School of Economics, and the London School of Economics was really the haven of Cannon. And I put here a little table which I did not have in the paper, but it shows that almost all of the controversies which Keynes had before, he had with Cannon or with the Cannon School. Now, some people may say that there was no Cannon School, but whenever Keynes published something, Cannon published something against it. And even if he didn't publish something, if they had public debates, Cannon talked against it. And it was really only after the general theory that Pigou became the partner of his controversies. Mark has written a review on a book, Keynes and His Controversies, and Cannon never, well, I think there is one mentioning of Cannon there. I think the economic community has only a very slanted view of the Keynes controversies. Cannon was very important. Now, Cannon was, why was he so important? He had the entire London School of Economics behind him. He was the expert on Adam Smith, and he was the representative of economic common sense. And one of these examples of common sense I reproduce here. When Keynes, at the time when Keynes had his tariff proposal, Cannon wrote, "The only object of exporting is to buy imports with the money for which the exports are sold. And if some export traders disappear or shrink, some trades supplying home consumption will come into being or expand because they will produce goods to take the place of some that were previously imported. The protectionist will see what he has always clamoring for, production at home of things formerly imported, though he will not have the satisfaction of attributing it to his nostrum of protection and will be puzzled to find it resulting from what he regards as disastrous, a falling off of exports. So exports are only for imports, so if you have less exports, you have less imports, but for that you must produce yourself. Actually, what it amounted to is that you can never have you can never work towards active trade balance, and of course that is the object of generating effective demand. Now, of course, that was not where the story ends as far as effective demand was concerned, but that is where Keynes really got into great problems. I have here a quote which shows the utmost importance which everybody, whether he now really agreed with Cannon or had another opinion, gave to Cannon as an authority. And I quote... in the paper, positions of the self-presentations of the LSE, saying there was controversies going on between LSE and Cambridge in the 30s. Well, actually, Cambridge was not in a comparable position as the LSE, which was really the canon school. Cambridge had the image of being the Marshall School, but it was very much diverse. In its positions. Now, I think an interesting quote. Part of this quote you will find in the paper. A continuation of this quote describes the position of Keynes after this also catastrophic discussion. And it describes his really, really pessimistic or, tragic feeling, which is very well expressed, and I would like to quote it therefore. Well, first he describes, my critics have not taken any notice of what he wanted to say. And then the second half of the quote says, they have been forcing me to chew over again a lot of stale mutton, dragging me along a route I have known all about as long as I have known anything, which cannot, as I've discovered by many attempts, lead one to solutions of our present difficulties, a peregrination of the catacombs with a guttering candle. Now, that was his condition, and the question was now, what could he do in this situation? Oops. The problem was that he was all alone with his idea of effective demand. Pigou did not support him. The counter school of the Cambridge school did not appear. And so really Keynes, I will have later on maybe occasion to discuss what he thought of a counter school to be. So eventually he took only after these attempts to have a controversy with the LSE people, he took up controversy against his orthodox colleagues in general. One of the triggers was that Pigou rather derided him. As I mentioned before, Pigou was dragged into a committee worked by Keynes, and when Pigou wrote his theory of unemployment in 1933, he said, well, the position of the economist is not in committees. He should be in the study room. And when he is in committees, an economist is really like an engine driver and not like an engineer. And at that time there was a theater play where there was a very pathetic engine driver. In my book I described it, and Vicky Chick was very kind to quote this and have some appreciative comments on that, but it would lead too far if we went into that now. Anyhow, Keynes was deserted by his colleagues, he was deserted by his immediate colleague Pigou, and he was ridiculed by his immediate colleague Pigou, so he had nothing to lose. And so he went into the argumentations of Pigou, and he took that up, took up some ideas. Now, I should go to the next point. What points did he take from Pigou, and then did he change it to his own theory of employment? Keynes, as you will know, I was instructed to ask you, have you read the general theory? And you should have read at least the chapter 2, where he talks about the postulates of classical economics. And there you will see he describes the two classical postulates. It is just a description that there are marginal conditions on the labor market fulfilled, A, for the firms, B, for the households. And it is maybe a bit torturous how to describe the supposedly fulfillment of the marginal conditions of the households. But anyhow, he says the one principle I accept, namely the first classical principle, that the marginal conditions for the firms are fulfilled, and the other is not fulfilled in my theory. Now you can have two views on that. You can say, okay, Keynes said that the marginal analysis of labor supply is rubbish. Throw it away. Now, or you could say, no, the conditions of equilibrium are not fulfilled, and actually you need to show that they are not fulfilled, but that doesn't mean that the analysis as such is rubbish. And it is the latter interpretation which I propose. Therefore, I have the second point in the paper, Keynes' acceptance of conventional utility functions, that is, the utility functions for labor supply, goods demand, and also intertemporal allocation. That is very important because very many people say his consumption function is drawn out of imagination. Actually, his consumption function is based on intertemporal allocation. People have a certain amount of money, and this money they want to spend now, but they want also to keep some money for the future, and that what they keep for the future is what they do not spend in this year, and that is savings. Now, what they keep for the future is based on utility considerations. Therefore, Keynes does accept the intertemporal utility considerations, you can derive the Keynesian consumption function from there. And then when it comes to comparing Keynes and Pigou, when you look at Pigou's theory of unemployment, the book against which Keynes argued in the general theory, you will see that Pigou there had a disaggregated model. He has two sectors of the economy, so Pigou did not resort to the simplistic macroeconomic production function as very many of the today's textbooks do. He has a somewhat elaborate construction by which we have sectoral employment in the wage goods sector related through some elasticities to total employment in the rest of the economy. So all this really was in Pigou and was really accepted by Keynes. The interesting thing is now, where does Keynes on this basis diverge from Pigou? Now, one interesting point is that he has a different function from the functions which Pigou had, and that is this Z function about which Mark has written, and he has already quoted the essential part. I quote it again because I fiddled around a little bit with the text, but I want to point out where is the problem. And what does Keynes do? Now, on page 55 and the following, Keynes has something which Mark very aptly called the footnote, because this footnote is the topic of disputes among many economists. And it reads, for example, let us take Z sub W equals function phi of n as the aggregate supply function. Then, since the proceeds of the marginal product is equal to the marginal factor cost at every point on the aggregate supply curve, we have delta n, and there are some elements which I leave out, equals delta z. That is to say, the slope, there is some derivative, phi dash equal 1. You see the difference of n is equal to the difference of z, so equal difference. So there he says derivative 1. Then he has another passage, provided that factor cost bears a constant ratio, and so on. He gives certain conditions. This means that if wages are constant and other factor costs are a constant proportion of the wages bill, the aggregate supply function is linear with a slope given by the reciprocal of the money wage. And then there is something missing. And one of the reasons why there is so much debate is what is missing there. And my theory is, with the word that is missing is the money wage share. Now, why is that so? Go into the construction of this ZW curve. The ZW curve is constructed on the basis of a neoclassical production function. Now, John Robertson maybe would say, now this is rubbish to have a function like this, but I think that was the reason for my preliminary remarks. Keynes did use and accept this function. And so what does it mean? Take a given amount of employment, n dash, then n bar. Then you have on the production function a point, Q bar, and if the firms produce profit maximizing, then the marginal product, which is given by the tangent in Q bar, is equal to the money wage. That is what is written here. Now, if that is the money wage, then the question is, what else can you get out of this? You can say that this horizontal stretch n dash r is what Keynes called z sub w. That is the total supply in wage units. What does it mean in wage units? Well, that is the quantity times the price divided by the wages. Now, you could also say, since I have cannot write here, I cannot reproduce what is in the paper, because there are two ways to argue this. One is that you say, you have here a triangle, and the stretch Q bar N bar is the quantity. So what is R N N bar? It is Z. So it is P over W times Q. Why? Well, because you have Q there and you have Q there. They cancel, and since the value of the tangent must produce the real wage. You have here a geometrical reason why this stretch R n dash n bar must be z sub w. Another reason is the total supply is equal to factor cost. Factor cost is wage cost and non-wage cost. Wage cost is, of course, in wage units, is, of course, employment. And the rest projected on the labor axis is OR, because, that is the projection of profits on this stretch. So RN dash is Z sub W. Now you can mirror this quantity from the first and second quadrant to the third and fourth, and then you'd have a 45 degree line, and then what do you get? You get here the value of Z sub W, which goes with this employment. So it relates the wages in wage units to output in wage units. Now, wages in wage unit to output in wage units is nothing else but the wage share of wages. This is total output in wages share. So if this is wages, so you have this value of tangent is lambda, the share of wages. Now the tangent value of the other angle is 1 over lambda. So that is what sensibly should be written there when Keynes describes the Z sub W function, that its slope is given over N and Z W by the reciprocal of the wages share. Therefore, you should put wages share in it. Now, the question is, what is this 45 degree line? That is not so controversial. It follows just from the marginal product, because when you have the marginal product, bad that I cannot write. But it is in the article by Mark, and you can by simple rearrangement show that this equilibrium condition does generate a 45 line. Now, what does this all mean? Well, it means if you call out different levels of employment, you get different RQ lines, but of course they have a different R, and from each R you then can construct a 45 degree line, and the thick line is really the locus of positions where you have a 45 degree line cutting the corresponding N bar. So, if one could paint here, one would then show that. Oh yes, you can show this. So you could say call out this level of employment. Then you have this R. You have the R there. Then you have to have your 45 degree line there. Now there you had your original employment for that R, and so on. So this you can construct with how we began with the first point on the Z line by just calling out different N bars. So that is really how this Z W line is constructed, and that means that that you have on the one hand this N dash equal 1, and on the other hand this other relationship. So that is ZW line constructed, mentioned in the footnote. Now, what is the point of this line? Well, the interesting point of this line is really that you have here a linear relationship between input and value of output, and there you have a non-linear relation between input and output. Now, non-linear equations, non-linear functions, equations, you cannot add. It gives nonsense. First of all, you cannot, when you have two sectors, here you have only one sector, but let us imagine we have two sectors. We have a sector producing apples and a sector producing bananas. You cannot add bananas and apples unless you make consommé or something. But that is not good for GDP calculation. So you must have a valuation, and when you value in terms of one good or other, you get problems. You get less problems when you value in terms of wage units. Why? On the one hand, you count the inputs in labor, and since you divide by the money amount by wages, you get the dimension of labor again. So we have labor input and labor output. Of course, it is only computational labor because you compute it that way. But it is dimensionally consistent. And since it is a linear equation, you could also add the equations together, the functions together. Okay, there are examples in the paper. Now, that is one point where Keynes could be seen to be critical of Pigou, or at least divergent from Pigou, but actually he still uses Pigouvian elements. Now, the next point is the idea of unemployment of unemployment in the strict sense. Now, I make a point in the paper that, well, what does it mean, unemployment in the strict sense? Well, you have employment fixed, you have a quantity fixed, like this, like we see here on this graph, involuntary unemployment. That gives, obviously, this position is profit maximizing. Why? Because the marginal product, shown as a tangent, is equal to the real wage, and that generates the demand for labor. Now, if we have this real wage, then we have this budget line for the community, and with this budget line, then the community would like to supply an amount of labor which corresponds to this indifference curve which I marked with you, and you see then that you have an excess supply of labor. The interesting thing is that if you look at this triangle in red, marked in red, you will see that the value of oversupply is equal to the value of overdemand. You have an oversupply of labor, and supply of labor, NS, is larger than the demand for labor. But you also have an over-demand for goods. Why? Because the people who want to work but cannot work would have liked to buy goods with that money which they could not earn. So you have really a notional demand of excess demand. You can see that here there's the excess demand meets really the value of excess supply meets the value of excess demand. You have here a situation where Walras law is valid. Now the question is, we should now discuss this. So we have here unemployment. What would the classics say? The classics say, well, this is clear why we have unemployment, because we have the wrong real wage. If the workers now negotiate for a lower wage, then this RL line will have a smaller slope, profits will go up, employers will ask for more labor. We will move from Q bar to the right. The indifference curves will meet, and they will meet somewhere where now the hand is. That means that demand goes up for labor, goes up, supply goes down. We have an equilibrium in the economy. Why does that happen? Well, because we have labor adjustment, wages adjustment. Now, if wages do not adjust, Is that a catastrophe? No, not really. You have to look to it that the price goes up. Now, normally firms, when they realize that there is excess demand for their goods, they should put up their price. Now, if they are too stupid to do this, then we need the government. The government will ask products which then will drive up the prices, and then we have a lowering of the real wage, and then we will have this shift of the RL line, which we just discussed as a solution to the unemployment problem. We could also have rising prices by expanding money that will drive up prices. Again, that will reduce the real wage. Now, that was the idea which Pigou and the rest of the colleagues gave. And that is why you hear again and again people who say, well, Pigou and Keynes said the same thing. Pigou said, make government expenditure and it will solve the situation. Now, they did not say the same thing. Why? Because Keynes said, we have, in addition to what goes on in this quadrant one, we have a demand function for consumers' good, and we have, for many people, nothing else. They demand consumers' good in this period, and that is it. They lay funds, they put funds aside in order to have something to spend tomorrow. Now, when that is the case, you have the problem that part of the output, and I simplify now by going back to the one output situation, which I said Keynes did not really want to have, but it simplifies the argument, and let us go through this. So we have here a function which says, if we have an increase in income, we will have an increase in demand for consumption goods, but we will have an increase with a slope less than 45 degrees. And then, else do we see here? We see here a 45 degree line. Now, this 45 degree line caused also lots and lots of problems to the public. What does it mean? The 45 degree line means that whatever is output is income. And I must quote this. I don't know whether I found this quickly enough in the text. Keynes alludes to this because he says that this is an incontrovertible truth. That, of course, whatever is produced, whatever is new output, must accrue to somebody. What accrues to somebody is really new is income. So you have here it is really just an accounting equation, saying that we have this income, and this income now must be absorbed by demand. So a certain demand, D2, must come up, and when you have this demand D1, a function of income, demand D2, which must be explained, then you have a total demand, and that fixes the demand for output. And you have, the question now is, where do you have the constraint in the economy? Have you the constraint with the L curve, that a certain real wage is given and constrains the economy, or do you have the constraint in the second quadrant, that you have a given demand which nails down the economy through the demand side to this quantity of Q bar? Keynes goes through this. He says, now you, in such a situation where you have Q bar, you can maybe lower the wages. What will happen? Will the employment go up? No, Because if the firms see that their costs go down, they will try to get an advantage against their competitors. So what will they do? They will go down with their price, trying to attract this little demand there is there. So what will happen? The wages go down, the price go down, the real wage is the same as it was before. So if you have this demand constraint, you cannot work on the money wage because the system will not move as long as, of course, as you have this constraint. Now, you could always say, no, this constraint is nonsense because in some way the demand will come up. And then, of course, you would say that you always move, that this income and the demand curve move parallel, that you have no constraint, and that means then that you have a demand which is always on the 45-degree line. Now, I discuss Say's law in this context in the paper, and I do not make the step to the aggregate supply function. Now, of course, you can have also the same discussion in the N and ZW plane. I have here now a slightly different consumption function. Why? Because the fourth quadrant and the fourth quadrant, which has now here the ZW function and the second quadrant are not congruent, do not correspond to each other. Why? I want to show here now what can you show in this quadrant. For example, if you had a 45-degree line as a consumption function, what would it show? It would show that the workers spend on consumption goods that what they earn. That is the so-called extreme classical consumption function. It says workers spend what they earn and entrepreneurs save what they earn. So there you have now the point that if you for some reason have this situation, then investment or the spending by the non-work income gainers would be here, and they would spend their profit. But the question is, how do you get them from this position where they are here to get to a position which is has full employment and not unemployment? And there, then you can say you might need government action. So this is, I think, how Keynes got into a critical position against the classics in the framework, which does use classic elements, namely the production function, a disutility of work function, and a consumption function, which can be developed from intertemporal allocation. But for seeing that, you would have to consult my appendix, I think C it is. Now, I think I have about five more minutes, if I may. Then maybe I read out maybe a passage concerning the frozen land metaphor, which Vicky Chick was so kind to like. The frozen land metaphor. Wherein lies now the fundamental difference between Keynes and Pigou? There are many minor points of difference which we covered so far concerning functional relations, problems of aggregation, choice of units, and so on. But whether these differences are essential or not is debatable and has been much debated. There is even the charge that Keynes was fraudulent with his claim of originality with his efficient demand. And I give the quote where that was claimed. There seems to be two ways how to bring Keynes' specificity into better focus: a consideration of historical precedent and a closer look at the time structure of the basic modeling approach. Actually, the two are interrelated. Now, historical precedent. Keynes when he was struggling with getting across this idea of effective demand, reread Thomas Malthus. Thomas Malthus had a controversy with Ricardo, and exactly about this this effective demand. And Keynes praised this controversy, and he praised very much Thomas Malthus that he really hit on the right idea. Now, I cannot really reproduce the quotes which Keynes gave, but maybe one quote. Keynes in 1933, so it was just about the row with Pigou starting, he wrote, "If only Malthus, instead of Ricardo, had been the parent stem from which 19th century economics proceeded, what a much wiser and richer place the world would be today. We have laboriously to rediscover and force through the obscuring envelopes of our misguided education what should never have ceased to be obvious. I have long I have long claimed Robert Malthus as the first of the Cambridge economists." The historical fact was that in 1793 Malthus was made a fellow of Jesus College, Cambridge, but afterwards then he was professor somewhere else. And he repeated this claim. Why did he praise Malthus? Malthus was working at the momentous results of the economy. Ricardo tried to find long-run equilibria. So one should, if one wants to find out the difference between Keynes and the classics, one should read again what Keynes found so interesting about the controversy between Malthus and Ricardo, but I think hardly anybody does this in Cambridge. I really have come to the limit of my time, but maybe this this little bit of conclusions, maybe they are a opportunity for discussions. The basic methodology of the general theory is anticipated ex post analysis, because that gives the possibility to give a snapshot of one realization of the time, and then to ask what will be the next snapshot. And I think that is how Keynes gets into the short period analysis. The analytical framework in which the general theory should be received is the post-Pigouvian, or is post-Pigouvianism. It is solidly based on the standard body of neoclassical economics. It incorporates Walras' law, as I've only been able to sketch, in the disequilibrium version of the formulation. It is best interpreted in a disaggregated Cobb-Douglas context, which also is described in the paper and not really shown sufficiently here. Keynes' wage unit approach is unfortunately far too little received in post-Keynesian literature. It has advantages of aggregation, which I went into very briefly and at quite some length in the appendix. Because Keynes' theory incorporates the validity of Walras' law in an ex post setting, it is a theory based on rationalized expectations, but not one based on rational expectations. Well, that is something for the discussion. And last sentence, Keynes dearly wanted to create a Malthusian tradition for Cambridge economics. Why he wanted that was because he knew how important it is to have a historical founded tradition like Cannon had it at the LSE, and then to have somebody who fosters this tradition. Well, it did not materialize in Cambridge, but Keynes wanted it. His breach with Pigou was most probably motivated to a large extent by Pigou's ineptitude to support Keynes in this attempt. As far as I can see, Keynes' desire is still unfulfilled. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Ambrosi, for that very stimulating talk. It's prompted me to write down about 6 questions, but I think I ought to let the floor have the first go.
Your claim about the validity of Bahrar's law is very interesting, and you use that to have this idea of rationalized expectations. But of course, the important point about the demand side of your demonstration is that the notional demand is notional. It doesn't show up, so that firms can't appreciate that there is an unfulfilled demand out there if more workers were to have been employed. What they have to go on is what they observe, which is the actual demand that occurs when they employ a certain number of people. So that the notional demand, which gives you your Walrasian counterpart to involuntary unemployment, isn't something that anybody can observe. And I think that was Keynes's point, wasn't it? Firms have to proceed on the basis of what they can know, and from an epistemological point of view, the notional demand is something they cannot know.
Yes and no. First of all, the workers, of course, they do have this urge, and they do go around, and it is imaginable that they would buy things if they could only sell their part. Why could you say Keynes does not employ the Walras law? Well, because Walras has this idea that there then will be the tâtonnement, and that by the price signals, then the firms will react. But what Keynes says is the price signals are not what interests the firms. What interests the firms is the turnover. They make a projection of turnover and not a projection of price. And they don't wait for somebody telling them the price, as Walras says. They have an expectation of turnover. That is what he says over and over again in the general theory. So you really must have a different micro foundations, and in the appendix, the micro foundations of effective demand, I draw it up that you should have the equation which says P times Q expectations. The definition of profits. Firms want profit. What is profit? Profit is turnover minus cost, of course. Cost could consist of wages turnover minus wages minus non-wage cost. But they have a constraint of expectations of turnover. And it is this constraint which has to move in order to move firms. And firms then calculate on the basis of this expectation of turnover. They calculate, given the market conditions, what they can charge for their output. Of course, they want to charge their output so that it can be sold on the market, so they anticipate the market output. But it is the causality is they expect turnover and not prices. And that is why I don't think it is a relevant counter-argument that you say you must have a negation of Walras' law in order to not get into the trap that you have this price tâtonnement. But as far as the plans of the households are concerned, I think if you think in these terms, and I think Keynes thought in these terms, you immediately have this notional demand, which indeed is only notional, and therefore, yes, I agree with you. But to maintain this disequilibrium version of Walras' law is not really detrimental for Keynes, because his system is such that it is not the price signals which count, but the turnover signals which count.
Can I go back?
May I jump in first? I'm not sure you can really sustain that distinction. I mean, I think we're all agreed that the Valarasa law that you've described is notional, and not effective, to use the Klaue Leuenhofer distinctions or terminology. But can you really separate turnover from price in a Marshallian system? I mean, Keynes's firms are entirely Marshallian, as you've demonstrated. So by turnover, I presume you mean what he calls proceeds, his expected proceeds.
Yes.
So you can't really separate the proceeds from the price. I mean, the expected price, immediately under assumptions of perfect competition and rising marginal cost, gives you an expected proceeds. So these two things are simply corollaries. They're not alternatives.
Well, I think you can construct it a little bit differently than the normal microeconomist does it, that you say under perfect competition firms are price takers. No, they are perfectly aware that there are market demand curves. Only they can imagine then that my share in the total market is diminutive. But I don't think that any firm believes that the prices stay constant. They believe that they have no influence on the quantity. But sure, that is the movements. So you can very well put quantity-dependent price equations into the calculations of the firms, but you must also put expressly into these calculations the idea: are they atomistic firms? And then you must put them as atoms into these firms, and then you can show they have no influence. But I think that is where maybe the formulation of the Marshallian school is wrong, that they say they are price takers. And there is where we must have a particularly Keynesian micro foundations, which I have it in the paper. Maybe I'm now discontented with my W bar. You have, first of all, the expectation of turnover. Then the firms translate this turnover into a market equation, and then the market equation has the total supply and then their individual supply. And if their individual supply has no effect on total supply, okay, then they are in the atomistic condition. Then they say, okay, price will not change no matter what I do. But they, no matter what I do, as long as I'm a little atom, as soon as they would change their share, of course, of the market, you would have a change. I think that is a more... So you can have calculations of price even by the atomistic firm in the micro foundation, as long as you say, okay, I'm aware that I'm a little atom, but I'm not unaware that the price can change.
This is on page 36, by the way, just for the record.
Yes. Mark has taken care of my first objection with the addition that I'd like to put in in your exposition. It sounded almost like the classic Hicksian Klaue Leuenhofer story about Keynes reversing the adjustment from prices to quantity, which I reject and Mark rejects, and you reject.
Yes.
Because we all know that price and quantity change together in this system. So that takes care of the first objection. On the second part of this, in response to what you've been saying in reply to Mark, I mean, I went to a lot of trouble in a paper that I wrote in Dow and Hillard to tackle this question of prices for the small firm and to try to crack open this package that we all have learned that the small firm is a price taker. I say, no, you've got to decouple that because the small firm is only a price taker in equilibrium. You can't be a price taker till there's a price to take. And to get the price to take requires the market, which is a summation of the supply functions for individual firms and a market demand curve. So only within equilibrium can firms be price takers, and this is not an equilibrium story. Now, if you're saying that, I entirely agree, and you know, to differentiate that story from the perfect competition story, I thought I invented the phrase, the term polypoly, and then I discovered Richard Kahn had got there before me some, I don't know how many years before, 30, 40, something like that. So polypoly indicates that there are lots of firms, you know, but decouples this story from the story of price taking. So I wasn't thinking in terms of price taking.
Yes. Well, if you have a polypoly, then you have the a minute share of every firm, and then no matter what you must weigh the influence of the individual firm by this minute share. It is not that the firm takes the price as given, it takes its minute share as given. And if that is zero, then the influence of the firm is zero on the price. And then the price cannot change for the firm.
So just to clarify, you would read at least the possibility of imperfect competition into the general theory.
Oh, yes, of course, yes. But that is parametrically given. That is, we take as given the degree of competition and so on and so on.
Right.
As far as what you said about the Clower argument quantities reacting faster than price, that is a legitimation for having an argument against along this L curve. And that is, of course, the wrong argument. You need, in addition... that is where Clower really has this figure, where you have this disequilibrium. And then there he says, what is the explanation for this disequilibrium to persist? Well, it is dynamics. And that is where I say, no, it is not dynamics, it is Keynesian effective demand. That is really the point which you must add, and that is which Clower, Lionhoof would do not add, and that is the problem with them.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay. Questions? Jens?
This is very Berlin style, I should say. We both graduated in Berlin, and I just take up that debate because I cannot agree with this that Keynes accepted the conventional utility functions. This may be for intertemporal even consumption functions. But I've always read the general theory as certainly disagreeing with the time preference determining the rate of interest. And that's something you just left out. And I find that surprising in the times we are in. So could you shed some light on that aspect? I mean, this is a very obscure chapter, of course, on liquidity preference, but you must have strong reasons to just not mention it.
Well, the strongest reason was the limitation of space. But indeed, what I did about chapter 17 is really separate. And also more or less on the competitive static side. Now, where I discuss this is Pigou's answer to Keynes in 37, where he has a so-called simplified model in which he brings across his idea of time preference determined interest rates. And there you have a very interesting debate between Kahn and Kahn and Keynes. And Kahn was adamant that Pigou is an utter idiot having this time preference determined interest rate. And astonishing enough, Keynes says, no, why? In the context of his assumptions, he's quite right. I agree with him. And so the question is, how can Keynes agree with this? And how can he agree? Construct his consumption function in a way that if you put into Kane's consumption function the assumptions which Pigou used, then, lo and behold, you get the time preference theory of interest. That is why Keynes can say, I have the more general theory, because if you put Pigou's assumptions into my function, then you get Pigou's result. But it is Pigou's special result. I give a simplified version in the appendix, appendix A, which I wrongly here have the two subpoints belong to A, but you have the paper, and please look at Appendix A. I will try to explain that there in a more simplified. In my book, it is in a very complicated way.
Basically, the point is, isn't it that the function of the rate of interest in the stationary state is to keep saving an investment equal to zero?
Yes.
That's the only function it has.
And that's why it's special. Okay.
And that's why it's special, because in the general theory, saving and investment are not equal to zero. It's not the stationary state.
Yes, you postulate a certain predetermined level of income, namely that which exhausts the income and which does not admit consumption savings. And there also, of course, Vicky Chick then says, there, of course, liquidity preference has no place, because you don't need liquidity, because every year is like the previous one, so you know what's happening.
I mean, I think this has clarified what you've said a bit, but I'm still with Jens a little uncomfortable, because I mean, I think what you're saying is that if you impose on the general theory the assumptions of the stationary state, well, then uncertainty disappears. Liquidity disappears, liquidity preference disappears, and yes, perhaps it's possible to say that Keynes could agree with Pigou. I'm not disputing that. But to say that what he's actually written about the nature of the consumption decision in the general theory, and to, I mean, what you seem to be suggesting, but you may not be, is that his consumption theory or function, anyway, is based on intertemporal optimization.
Yes.
Are you
subscribe
saying
to that? Yes. I will be crucified for this.
You will, because I mean, it seems to me there's a fundamental divide here between, I've just been talking to my students about it, between an intertemporal theory of consumption based on calculation, on optimization, on the models that we know, and a theory of consumption based on psychology, of which, of course, psychology may include elements of calculation. And there's actually rather a nice quote here, if I may dig it out. Page 108, the general theory, where he's talking about the motives to saving. These eight motives might be called the motives of precaution, foresight, calculation, improvement, independence, enterprise, pride, and avarice. And we could also draw up a corresponding list of motives to consumption, such as enjoyment, short-sightedness, generosity, miscalculation, ostentation, and extravagance. Now, that doesn't sound to me like intertemporal macroeconomics.
Well,
and you know, and I think if you think the way the wind is blowing even today in economic theory, people are beginning to think in terms of behavioural economics, behavioural finance, and surely we should be, you know, identifying that actually Keynes was ahead of the game here, that he recognised that. Although you can say something about consumption, or you can relate consumption to equilibrium modelling, which is what you've demonstrated, the coefficients of consumption, the propensity to consume, and so on, these are not arrived at by a process of careful calculation by the individuals. They are psychological. As far as his theory is concerned, they are psychological givens.
I'm unimpressed. The reason why I'm unimpressed is compare these passages to Irving Fisher, The Theory of Interest. There, when you look there, he talks about the sailors and about whatnot, more or less in the same lingo. So if you say Keynes was a precursor of behavioral economics, then you can say Fisher is the same. There is no distinction really in what the way they write between Fisher and Keynes. So okay, maybe they are precursors, but there is no difference between.
Well, I would suggest that the difference is that Fisher then goes on to attempt to reduce that psychology to, you know, an equilibrium construction based on marginal utility and all the rest of it. Keynes doesn't. He just accepts the given. You know, the psychological law of the marginal propensity to consume is not in any sense justified by marginal considerations. It is, I think, and this is another debate, a condition of the stability of the equilibrium, the existence of the equilibrium. But he doesn't have a theory of why it is at a particular level. He makes a number of general, you know, historical, sociological, psychological statements about it, but he doesn't in any sense claim that it's based on careful calculation. But maybe we've had enough on that one. But
isn't the question whether it is only time preference? And there I think the answer has to be no. Or whether time preference has no role to play. These are the two polar extremes.
Yeah.
Okay. Where, again, possibly the answer is no. And time preference is in there. You stressed it in your reading, which is all that Michael requires, I think, to say that if you strip everything else out and impose a stationary state on the general theory, then Keynes can agree with Pigou. Isn't that the way that the argument goes?
I would go further, and maybe in the book, when you get to that, I go through this. You can all the comparative static propositions which Keynes does have about the consumption function, you can derive from a micro-founded consumption function, a la. Later on, Friedman made some claims. Of course, when you put the assumptions of Friedman into a micro-founded consumption function, you get the results of Friedman. But Keynes gets them as well. He says when we have windfall profits, then we have maybe one of the strongest influences on the consumption function. So, of course, he says when you have changes in wealth, then you have changes in consumption. He doesn't say you have only changes in consumption when you have changes in the present income.
Yeah, sure.
Not at all.
No, yeah, I agree.
And when he admits that there are other things, and he says it has maybe the strongest influence on through the rate of interest is through its influence on windfall profits, then he admits that there is an influence on of interest rates on consumption. He says there is maybe a strong one. And all this you can get out of a micro-founded, but if you are happier without the micro-foundation, but if you say the micro-foundation is already in Keynes, then you take the wind out of Friedman and all those who say Keynes was just talking gibberish and now I must come in order to make a theory out of it. Keynes worked with Ramsay on intertemporal on the optimal savings. So to say Keynes had no idea with intertemporal would be really off the mark. So maybe he cut it out when he wrote the general theory. I don't know. But anyhow, Keynes knew very well what it means to have intertemporal optimization.
Sure. Well, I think we probably covered that one for the moment. I've got another question, but I mean, let me make room for anybody else. I mean, you talked about, when we're talking about the Z function, you mentioned that I don't quite follow the argument yet, but essentially the 45-degree line is quite important in your construction, I think, yes? And what I would say is that the 45-degree line appears to be there in the text, if you take it literally. I mean, that's the way it's always been interpreted. And as you perhaps know, my interpretation is that it isn't actually a 45-degree line, but there's still an issue about whether it's linear or not. And this was... Mm-hmm. You consider this an important point from the perspective of aggregation, yes? But even its linearity, I would argue in the footnote, and here I have Vicky to comment as well, depends on special assumptions, which, for the lack of a better word, we can call Cobb-Douglas assumptions, which Keynes brings in the context of that footnote to demonstrate the correspondence or the ability of his approach to the theory of value with the classical theory of value. In other words, he's saying that you can restate the classical marginal productivity theorems in terms of Z values, expected proceeds, and give rise to similar propositions. I mean, if I may just find the piece, you know, he says, this set of definitions has the advantage that we can equate the marginal proceeds or income to the marginal factor cost, and thus arrive at the same sort of propositions relating marginal proceeds thus defined to marginal factor costs, as have been stated by those economists who, by ignoring user cost or assuming it to be zero, have equated supply price to marginal factor cost. And the burden of my argument is, as he constructs this linear Z curve for that precise purpose and no other, that in general, the Z functions in the general theory are concave or convex, depending which way you're looking at it.
Well, they can be of both sides, because it depends on the elasticity of substitution, whether it is larger, it is linear when it is 1, it is concave if it is greater than 1, and convex, or whichever way you look at it, when it is lower than 1. You can get any change if you have any movement, any shape, when you have other than elasticity of substitutions equal to 1. Well, if you want to have it varying, then you could also say, well, we use this as a first approximation, and then we can always have then these Cobb-Douglas coefficients moving. You can sort of have a, what is this? Poincaré, you can always express a nonlinear function by some arrangements with linear terms that you bring in all sorts of. You can always linearize a nonlinear function, so you could always get to that, to a linear function, even if you have a nonlinear function.
You mean you can linearize it in general, or just as an approximation?
As an approximation, yes. In a point, it is linear,
yes.
And then you have you can. I don't know whether you can, of course, have elasticity. Well, you have. This is a very bad print, but you can, of course, have elasticities of the elasticities of production, and then these elasticities of the elasticity of production, the elasticity of production, the Cobb-Douglas coefficients, are first of all given, but they have elasticities of their own, and so then you can approximate nonlinear functions by this assumption. Well,
Sounds like an infinite regress.
Pardon?
Sounds like an infinite regress.
Well, yes, you can go to details as deep as you want to go. You can put one elasticity after the other,
yes, yes.
And at some stage it is not sensible to continue anymore. No, well, if you want to have non-linear z functions, go ahead. But if you have linear ones, it has certain advantages. And it has advantages concerning aggregation. And so if you want to do empirical economics with Keynes and with Keynes' z function, take it linear, because then you can do all the little toys of econometrics with them. If they have non-linear ones, you cannot.